Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
This is Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It's KCRW's new show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California.
Congressman Schiff, we will not be censored. How about that?
Perfect.
Good? Let's try it. Let's go on the sidewalk with our signs and then we'll do it.
It's a residential street in Beverly Hills. It's the end of the day, the sun is going down, and a group of protesters is figuring out what they want to yell at local Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff.
What's our line again?
We will not be censored.
Schiff is giving an address to a group of supporters inside a synagogue on this evening, but here on the street, there is no love for the Burbank congressman.
Adam Schiff is full of shit. He's taking away our constitutional rights.
Now, in recent years, when you've heard about Schiff, it's likely been about Donald Trump, about collusion, about Russia's meddling in the 2016 elections. He's an ardent critic of Trump on cable news, but these protesters don't care.
I'll count it down. Let's practice.
These folks on this recent evening have passionate feelings about vaccinations. They're so-called anti-vaxxers who believe their children are at risk by being required to vaccinate against serious diseases. They say Adam Schiff wants to shut them up and brand them as conspiracy theorists. But plenty of people in the medical community say their theories are conspiratorial and a menace to public health.
Seriously, ready?
Congressman Schiff, we will not be censored. Congressman Schiff, we will not be censored. Congressman Schiff, we will not be censored.
So the person who recorded what you just heard in that Beverly Hills neighborhood is KCRW reporter Saul Gonzalez, who's with us right now. Hey, Saul.
Hey, Steve.
So why were these people so angry at Adam Schiff?
Well, the congressman had just sent a letter to the CEOs of Facebook and Google, and he was telling them he was worried about social media platforms like Facebook and YouTube and Instagram helping to spread really bad information about vaccinations, especially required inoculations for children. Essentially, Schiff says social media sites help to gin up fears and conspiracy theories about vaccinations, even though there's medical consensus that vaccinations are safe and effective.
So why did you go to this protest in the first place? I mean, where did you hear about it?
Well, Steve, I found out about the protest online, and I wanted to go because it happened just as we started getting news of a spike in measles outbreaks in the United States, including some cases here in California. And now, Steve, the U.S. has the highest annual number of measles cases since the year 2000, hundreds and hundreds of them. And the year 2000 is important because that's when the Centers for Disease Control declared that measles, a communicable illness that's killed millions around the world, had basically been eliminated in the U.S. because of vaccination programs. And the CDC says that in this outbreak, the measles virus is most likely to target families that don't vaccinate their children. So I wanted to hear from the anti-vaxxers directly, especially parents, about how they justify not getting their kids inoculated. And there's a good number of them here in Southern California. So I showed up at the protest, wandered around the crowd, and talked to people. I spent time with one father in particular.
My name is Jesus Arizaga. We are here with my family, my wife and my son.
Hello, hello.
And our son is unvaccinated. He has no vaccines. He's 11 years old and never been in a doctor's office in 11 years. So I think that means he has no health problems.
Could it just be luck?
Hmm?
Could it just be luck, good fortune? You dodged the bullet?
I don't think so. It's not just luck. It's because we take care of him. His diet is perfect diet. We are vegans.
Is your son enrolled in school now? Or?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. He's in school now.
How does that work when you have to be vaccinated in California unless you have a medical exception?
Well, we have a medical exception.
May I ask, is it, and please don't take this question the wrong way, is it a real medical exemption? Or
yes.
Is it something that someone just, you got someone to sign?
Well, it's a doctor. A doctor who signed it.
Have you played out the scenario that, heaven forbid, if your son gets sick
yes.
from from a disease that there's a vaccination against, goes to school, gets other people sick. What's your responsibility?
My son is unvaccinated, and other kids are vaccinated. Where's the problem? They are protected with the vaccines.
So yes, but you know, the physicians would argue that if everybody thought that way, then nobody would get vaccinated, and you'd have diseases run rampant the way they used to.
Why they refuse to have a real study, independent study, between vaccinated people, kids, and unvaccinated?
I think the scientific community say there's a mountain of those studies, and that you and being opposed to it might be picking and choosing the studies that you like, that agree with your philosophy.
Oh, no.
No?
No.
Is there anything that would make you change your mind? Is there any evidence, amount of evidence you can be given? Like, okay, now I'm ready to rethink my view, or no?
I haven't seen any real evidence to make me change my mind enough or just a little bit to raise my son's health. It's my only son, and I don't want to have another
one. I get it. I only have one son, too. I totally get that.
So,
but may I ask you something? As the father of only one son as well?
Yes.
If my son was in the class with your son?
Yes.
Why shouldn't I be worried?
Why are you worried? Your son is vaccinated. He's protected. My son is not protected.
So you're saying let me do it and let others do it.
If my son is not protected and your son is, why are you fear of it? Why are you scared?
So, Steve, that was a pretty good example of the kinds of conversations I had with anti-vaxxers. They were people who felt they could best protect their own children by not getting them vaccinated.
Mm.
But the longer I stayed at the protest and the longer I engaged with people, frankly, it just got weirder and more conspiratorial and more out there, especially when I asked the anti-vaxxers whether they felt they might have a responsibility to tell people they hadn't vaccinated their kids.
That's like putting a Jewish star on me to say that we're going to start separating the Jewish people from the non-Jewish people. Or are we going to...
Let me ask you a question. Is it to stick them in internment camps, the ones who aren't vaccinated?
No, I don't think anybody's advocating it.
It's gonna... Yeah, I think I've heard it. Like,
from
we
who?
Do not
want... Who said,
no, but it's already happened.
You know it's happened for the Japanese
children.
People.
Right.
So the conversation pretty much hit a dead end after that exchange. You can really get sucked through the looking glass when you start talking about vaccination with committed anti-vaxxers.
Well, I mean, especially, I mean, when you're talking about internment camps and things like that, it seems like it's quite a leap. And we can't emphasize this enough, Saul, though, that the vast majority of doctors say vaccinations are effective, but they're safe, right?
Absolutely. Not only that, Steve, but they think that vaccines are considered one of the clearest examples in history of science creating really a big win for all of humanity. And they talk about all of the countless lives that have been saved and the suffering that's been avoided. I mean, just think of the polio vaccine.
1955, a year of anxiety and triumphs. A major medical hurdle was crossed with the discovery by Dr. Jonas Salk of the anti-polio vaccine, which was to spread a mantle of protection over millions of American children. Each hastily set up center became a mecca for anxious parents shepherding little Johnny and little Jill to their inoculations. They're protected, and it didn't hurt a bit.
And Steve, I wonder what it's like to be a frontline physician now, talking to families about vaccinations. So I met pediatrician Alice Kuo. She practices in Santa Monica and Redondo Beach and shared some of what she hears from parents and what she thinks is fueling vaccine skepticism.
I don't encounter a ton of anti-vax outright sentiment among parents. What I get is a lot of vaccine hesitancy. So parents that have a lot of questions, whereas, you know, previously, maybe 10 years ago, you didn't get as many questions.
What's been the one big factor that's changed the conversation about vaccination?
I think it's definitely the presence of social media. Even just yesterday, I was seeing a brand new baby. And even though the vast majority of the questions was how to feed the baby, breastfeeding issues, sleep cycle issues, immunizations came up right away. And the first set of shots are not until 2 months. But this mother was very concerned because she had been reading on the internet and had some questions about it. And so that's usually the lead-in to the discussion. I read on the internet. I heard from my friends on social media. I read on Facebook. And so I think social media has been a game changer for this debate because, you know, there's always been vaccine skeptics ever since vaccines have been on the scene. But social media has given that very, very small minority a large voice, a large megaphone to promote their message, and I think has caused a lot of confusion amongst parents.
KCRW's Saul Gonzalez, and that's what you heard from people at that anti-vaccination protest.
Right. You heard some of that earlier in the show. I saw this on YouTube. I read this on social media site X, Y, or Z about the perils of vaccines.
All right, Saul, I'll just push back a little bit then and ask you, do the anti-vaxxers, or did they at this point, have any good points to make? Or are vaccines really completely 100% safe?
Well, Steve, you know, in a word, no. Vaccines are not 100% surefire safe in all people. But, and there's a lot of but here, physicians say in the vast majority of cases, getting vaccinated poses no health risks. And for vaccines to provide a blanket of protection for everyone in society, almost everyone needs to get them. Let's go back to physician Alice Kuo.
Well, as with any medication or any intervention, there are side effects and there are adverse outcomes. So, you know, we have an entire system to address children who may have experienced adverse outcomes because of vaccinations. If there was a way to have that conversation in a way that appropriately put it in the context that it's really, really, really rare and that you should still vaccinate your children, I think that that would be appropriate. And that is sort of the way it is. Like, people are aware that this happens, but, you know, similarly, it's important to realize for the public health, though, that we still need to maintain that herd immunity. We still need to get to, you know, above 95% for people who have been vaccinated to protect those in our community who aren't able to get vaccines. Because I think the parents of those children who are immunocompromised, either because they have an immune deficiency or because they have cancer and are undergoing treatment that wipes out their immune system, those parents would give anything to be able to vaccinate their children. And I think those are real, and the adverse outcomes are hypothetical.
Are the adverse outcomes always hypothetical, though? Or are there real-world cases yet where a kid has been vaccinated and it's done some real harm?
Correct. But they're very, very, very rare. And they're very difficult to prove as well. And we have had cases in which it's been arbitrated through the courts that it was determined to be, you know, vaccine-related. And then it turns out, like, a second child in the family had the same neurologically devastating condition, and it was actually something genetic.
Again, that was Dr. Alice Kuo. But Saul Gonzalez, I thought here in California we had new and tougher laws that require parents to get their kids vaccinated. What happened to those?
Well, we do, Steve, and that's because of a disease outbreak in late 2014 that was traced to the happiest place on Earth.
Health officials fear thousands may have been exposed to the measles at Disneyland and Disney California Adventure last month. Most of those who got the disease were not vaccinated against it.
And after that outbreak, Steve, California passed a law that required parents to get their children vaccinated, even if it was against their religious or personal beliefs. But California still allows a medical exemption for vaccination if parents get a doctor's signature. But a lot of public health officials feel parents are basically shopping around for doctors who will grant a medical exemption for really no good reason. You heard me bring that up with a father at the anti-vax protest earlier. So now State Senator Richard Pan, a doctor, by the way, and a co-sponsor of that first vaccine bill a couple of years ago, he's introduced a bill to crack down on those medical exemptions.
Is there any place, Saul, where it's sort of a hot spot? Like, are there, you know, like enclaves of places where anti-vaxxers have sort of thrived?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's a big anti-vax hotspot in Northern California. And then here in Southern California, you're talking about places like the South Bay, West LA, Santa Monica, wealthier communities
more
generally.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I talked to some experts about this, and they say it's kind of more related to a worldview that comes with wealth and parents who, you know, who feel that because of their status in society, because of what they make, maybe they feel that they know what's good for their child and that they'll make decisions for their child, even if it flies in the face of a lot of expert opinion.
Mm. All right. KCRW, Saul Gonzalez. Saul, thanks for coming in.
Hey, thank you.
Well, let's bring Dr. Michael Wilkes, who teaches medicine at UC Davis, and he hosts the KCRW podcast, Second Opinion. Dr. Wilkes, thanks for joining us right now.
Oh, it's nice to be with you, Steve.
You heard what the folks that Saul spoke with are saying. What is your initial reaction to some of the things that are being bandied about?
So I think it's important that we put this into two categories. There are folks that are vaccine hesitant, and they're confused. They're not sure what to do. And then there are the vaccine refusers, and they're a little bit more militant. Perhaps some of them are a bit concerned about conspiracy theories and things. But I think that at the very bottom, these are all concerned parents. They're all scared, and they all want to do what's very best for their child.
Sure. And that's the thing that I was struck with, is the fact that you hear the emotions. These are parents who can certainly be very protective of their children, who are. How do you then, as a physician, effectively communicate with them to spread the message of sort of the greater good? Like, you know, everybody's child is a part of this.
Yeah. So I think that the deniers you're going to have a really hard time with. But those who are vaccine hesitant, you know, it really is not the traditional paternalistic approach of let me tell you how it is. I think that our job as healthcare providers is really to have a conversation and to listen to what they're afraid of and try to address those fears without resorting to lots of technical terms around herd immunity and risks and benefits, but to try to have those conversations in colloquial English. At the end of the day, it is mom and dad's decision in terms of what has to get done. But we sort of come at this vaccine story with sort of two groups of vaccines, some that are super effective. And we would put measles and mumps and rubella and meningitis and hepatitis A and B and others into that category. But some have been a little bit less well proven, like the human papillomavirus, for example. Yet those are incredibly heavily marketed by pharmaceutical companies. We've moved from an era where we have sort of the medical community and the public health community that are trusted, stewards of our well-being, to a situation where we now have lots of misinformation and advertising. We have lots of examples where pharmaceutical companies have not been honest with us and told us either half-truths or mistruths about drugs. So it's hard for doctors to understand who's telling the truth and who's not. And then comes along some research, and that research is to the lay public. It looks like it's pretty good. And it says that there's this link between autism and vaccinations. Now, no studies have ever replicated those findings. Even after studying more than 600,000 kids for more than 10 years, the doctor who did the original study had his license taken away as a snake oil salesman. So now the public is in this situation where this has sort of taken on a life of its own, the Wakefield study, if you will. It's really hard for the public to separate who's telling the truth and who isn't telling the truth. But I do believe that your doctor, your family physician, your internist, your pediatrician, who you have a relationship with, can actually put this into the right context for you, particularly for those who are hesitant.
Now, we talked about the number of cases of measles. This is the big example that we're talking about in the Pacific Northwest. It's still, though, Michael, only a few hundred cases all across the United States. Is that really cause for concern?
Well, measles is an amazingly contagious disease. It makes hepatitis and HIV and others seem, you know, almost not contagious. It's so contagious. So if you have this spread at a park or at a baseball game or something, it can wreak havoc. If you haven't reached this scientific concept that we have called herd immunity. So that assumes that somewhere about 90 to 95% of a population has to be immunized to protect the entire population. And in the United States, most places are close to that level. But you do, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, you have isolated communities of vaccine deniers. And when that gets down to 40% or 60%, or 70%, it is a recipe for public health disaster.
If you had a sign at that anti-vaxxer rally that Saul went to, say you had a blank poster board and a marker, a Sharpie, what would you write on that sign if you were trying to tell them something?
Ice cream for sale. I'm not sure I'd go there. I certainly,
are you serious?
I would no more go to a vaccine deniers rally than I would go to a Make America Great Again rally. They're the wrong people, and we're should let them go. They're not going to be convinced. It's that middle group, that the group that Dr. Kuo calls the vaccine hesitancy group, that you can really change some minds. But it's not at a rally. It really is by having individual discussions and listening very carefully.
The quote-unquote independent voter, as it were.
Exactly.
Dr. Michael Wilkes, who teaches medicine at UC Davis in Northern California, he hosts the KCRW podcast, Second Opinion. Michael, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Steve.
Well, coming up, in the wake of Mayor Eric Garcetti's green new Angelino deal, some critics say he needs to ratchet it up. That's straight ahead on Greater LA. Steve Chiatake is back with Greater LA. Mayor Eric Garcetti is out with his Angelino Green New Deal plan. It includes fewer vehicles and cleaner vehicles. I spoke to him about it yesterday.
By 2025, we're not going to buy a bus that isn't electric. Companies are coming in saying we want autonomous rideshare vehicles. I want to mandate that 100% of those be electric.
But LA's air quality has been getting worse, and critics say the mayor's plans won't fix that quickly enough. Alyssa Walker is the urbanism editor at Curbed, and she's our transportation commentator here at Greater LA. Hi, Alyssa.
Hi, Steve.
The mayor's plan, Alyssa, includes eliminating coal and electricity generation by the year 2025, 100% clean power by the Olympics in 2028, just a few years after that, and increasing stormwater capture. The list goes on and on. What do you say to those goals?
It is good that we have goals because now we have metrics to measure our success. So I'm very happy that there are goals. There is a lot of concern that these goals are not aggressive enough. There are other cities that have much more aggressive goals when it comes to specifically transportation. And I'm not going to throw any European cities out there because everyone always says, we're not Copenhagen, we're not Amsterdam. Copenhagen has a carbon neutral plan where they are planning to not only eliminate emissions, but also offset any other emissions that they might create in about 6 years is what they're aiming for. But I want to use an example that's a little bit closer to home. Vancouver, for example. Vancouver set a goal that 50% of all trips would be taken using walking, biking, or transit, and they already beat it.
Number one, Vancouver's a much smaller city. Number two, it's in a different country. Number three, it's not as sprawled out as Los Angeles.
You know, the mayor wants to hit the goal of hitting that 50% mark of walking, biking, and transit not until 2035. And that is a long time away. That's many years that we will have to be subjected to more traffic fatalities, more childhood asthma. We're now number eight in the world when it comes to new childhood asthma cases. And there is a latent demand in the city. You can see last weekend we had a Ciclovia event. Once again, we have hundreds of thousands of people who are out at these open streets events on the weekend on a Sunday. And then on Monday, they get back in their cars because they don't feel safe. So we have to look at, are we truly offering enough choices for people to make that decision to get out of their car? I don't think we are. Right now, we have a mode share or mode split, as planners might say, of about 14% of trips are taken walking, biking, and on transit or scooters, what have you.
Not 50% like Vancouver.
Yeah. Not
14%.
14%. So if the goal, I think the first goal is to double that by 2025. So if you think about how much year on year that has to increase, the infrastructure has to reflect the changes. Like, I have two kids. How am I supposed to get my two kids to school and in a way that makes them feel safe? They would love to ride their scooters to school. Am I going to take them in a bike lane, an unprotected bike lane in my neighborhood? There's no way. But you go to other places like Vancouver, other cities in European countries that will not be named, and you do see very young children who are with their parents using these different modes to get to and from school, to and from work. And if I could do that every day in a way that feels safe, I try to do as much as I can. Taking the bus is fun with kids, but it doesn't work for everybody, and we need to make it work for everybody.
Alyssa Walker, urbanism editor at Curbed. She's a regular contributor here at Greater LA. Alyssa, thanks.
Thank you.
And that's Greater LA for today. Our producer, Catherine Barnes, managing producer, Christian Bordahl, managing editor, Sonia Geis. Technical folks include Reg Warna, engineer, Phil Richards. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day. Let's do it again tomorrow, shall we?